We'll do council appearances after I make some opening remarks. Good morning, everybody. My name is Pat Ward. I'm the administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as a hearing officer for this hearing. This is a hearing on the application of Otter Tail Power Company for permission to increase electric rates. The case is PU-17-398. The record will show it is a little past 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time, July 11, 2018. We're in the PSC hearing room on the 12th floor of the State Capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the date, time, and place set by the notice of hearing issued by the Public Service Commission on February 27, 2018. The Commission's notice of hearing for this hearing specified the following issues to be considered and determined. One, what is the value of Otter Tail's property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota? Two, what is Otter Tail's rate of return on its property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public of North Dakota? Three, what is a just and reasonable rate of return on Otter Tail's property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota? Four, what rates and charges are necessary to provide a just and reasonable rate of return on Otter Tail's property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota? And five, are Otter Tail's proposed rate schedules designed in such a manner that they result in a basis of charge to his customers that is just and reasonable without discrimination? Council, before we get to your appearances, I do understand there's been a settlement. There's a settlement agreement, and that the focus of the hearing today is going to be to prove up the settlement and to allow the commissioners to ask any questions they might have the settlement. That being said, I'll turn it over first to Council for Otter Tail Power to identify yourselves for the record and anyone sitting at council table.
Thank you, Judge Ward. Good morning, Commissioners. Kerry Stephenson on behalf of Otter Tail Power Company, and with me at the table I have my colleague Chris Dahl and also Bruce Gerhardsen, our Vice President of Regulatory Affairs.
Thank you. And Mr. Pelham, would you identify counsel for the PSC?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Commissioners. Zachary Pelham, counsel for PSC Advocacy Staff. To my left, also counsel for PSC Advocacy Staff, Jack Hsu, and to my far left, Victor Shook.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, Advisory Counsel, and with me is Jerry Lean, a Public Utilities Analyst.
Thank you. And the interveners present in the room, Mr. Savicol.
Good morning, Your Honor. Richard Savico from the law firm of Martin & Squires on behalf of the Midwest Large Industrial Customers.
Thank you. And my understanding is that Walmart Council is on the phone. They have identified themselves prior to my opening the record. If you would just please identify yourselves, and I have permitted this in an order that I issued. So as far as appearances or Miss Mann needing to hang around, I understand that she has more important things to take care of, and that's totally understandable. So I'm going to allow you to leave after you identify yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Rebecca Mann on behalf of Walmart.
And Talbot Wisorik on behalf of Walmart. Thank you, Your Honor. Miss Mann is currently bedridden because she broke her leg. If we would allow her to be released and allow me to appear without the need of pro hoc, I would appreciate that.
That is granted.
Thank you. I'm hanging up now.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Stephenson, any opening remarks that you'd like to make for the record?
Yes. Good morning, Commissioners. We appreciate the opportunity to be before the Commission this morning and to present a settlement agreement for your consideration. And the way the company would like to proceed is that I'll call Mr. Gerhardsen to testify in support of the settlement agreement. And he has a brief PowerPoint presentation, a copy which I think is before you, and it's marked as Exhibit Number 49. And the PowerPoint explains and provides context for the settlement agreement. And after that, Mr. Gerhardsen will be available for questions. In addition to Mr. Gerhardsen, all of the Otter Tail employees who provided pre-filed testimony in this matter are available for questions, and as you can see, most of them are here in person. those that are not here are available by phone. In addition to our employees, we have here today Kevin Moog, who is the Chief Financial Officer of our parent company, Otter Tail Corporation, and Mr. Moog also provided pre-filed testimony. And finally, we have available by phone our cost of capital expert, Robert Hevert, and our marginal cost study consultant, Ms. Amparo Nieto. And these witnesses will be available as needed. And I do want to underscore one point, that the record in this matter has been fully developed. All the parties have filed extensive direct testimony. OTP did so in our application. Staff and interveners did so in May following extensive discovery. Otter Tail and the large energy consumer intervener filed rebuttal testimony in June. And we filed sewer rebuttal testimony in July. And as I noted, staff has conducted extensive discovery, and I think it's fair to say that no stone has been left unturned. We received and responded to over 1,200 written questions, and I think the commission can take confidence from that there's been a rigorous and thorough review of our application. And the settlement is the result of extensive negotiations, and it reflects what the parties believe is a fair and reasonable result. And Otter Tail asks that the commission approve it in its entirety.
Thank you. Mr. Pelham, any opening remarks?
Just briefly, thank you, Your Honor. Just to follow up on comments by Mr. Stephenson, quadrilateral negotiations, four parties negotiation was completed after, as Mr. Stephenson indicated, after extensive discovery, extensive testimony, pre-filed testimony being submitted, extensive review of the documentation, the testimony being presented, and give and take. And that resulted in the settlement agreement that's going to be presented to you today, commissioners. On behalf of advocacy staff, Victor Shook will be called as a witness to provide testimony as to, from advocacy staff's point of view, the appropriateness of the settlement agreement in this particular case. All of the consultants retained by advocacy staff and who provided pre-filed testimony are available if needed, if questions arise as to any of their testimony, and can be called as witnesses if necessary. So I look forward to hearing from the company as its explanation as to the settlement agreement, and as well as hearing from Mr. Shook as to advocacy staff's position of the appropriateness of this settlement agreement. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, comments? Mr. Savico?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to thank the parties. I think Otter Tail has been a good utility to work with, open and helpful in working through these cases, specifically Mr. Shook and advocacy staff, likewise very helpful to our group and our experts. MLEC, the Midwest Large Electric Consumers, is a group of Otter consumers in Otter Tail's footprint, both in Minnesota and North Dakota. For this rate case, seven of Otter Tail's largest ratepayers worked together to form the group and intervene in this case. Our experts took on issues from financial to reporting and performance, and then finally class cost of service allocation and design issues. We think a reasonable settlement came into formation after several calls and hard work by experts in this case. One of our chief concerns at the onset of this case was the competitiveness of the LGS rates. We did notice that while Otter Tail had good and very competitive rates overall and from a residential perspective, we didn't think that was the case for the LGS group. Our review of the class cost of service study really supported this, and that relative to cost, the LGS customers had been paying significantly more. This settlement won't close the gap and bring all the parties to cost, but it will bring parties closer, parties being the classes, closer to their actual cost on the system, and will not further cause a problem with respect to the competitiveness of the large industrial group. So with that, we are supportive of the settlement. We do have our witnesses available for phone by phone for cross-examination, and we appreciate your attention to the matter today.
Thank you. Mr. Wieczorek.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of Walmart, I would echo the comments made by all counsel that everybody worked diligently for resolution. Walmart has its witness available by phone if the commission would have specific questions as to Walmart, whose primary testimony issues was cost of service and ROE issues. Thank you.
Okay, opening comments from the commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
Oh, good morning, everyone. And I want to start by saying thank you to all of the parties involved for the work that you've put in to the settlement. It's always good to come into these things with a settlement in place. But with that being said, I still have a number of questions that I'll be asking as we move through the proceeding. And the company is going to have to make the argument in terms of how different rate classes were treated as a result of the settlement. I do have a concern with the residential increase, the proposed increase on the residential side, and removing some of the volumetric charges and shifting them over into rate base. So I want to see a little more here, a little bit more. I'll be honest, I haven't had a tremendous amount of time. The settlement just came in prior to the hearing, so I spent the better part of yesterday and whatnot going through the numbers. So I'll save the questions, obviously, as we have individuals that come up on the stand. But I also want to just, again, echo thank you for the work everybody has done. We had a lot of very smart people working on this, and I appreciate that effort.
I want to give you that for your comments. You didn't miss it.
I didn't even know it was missing.
Chairman Christman.
I had looked over and noticed it missing.
I don't know if this means I have to go again or.
So yeah, it's nice having settlements, but last minute settlements kind of make this job a little more challenging. And yeah, it's 5 days, but with previous commitments that we had made so that we could free up the days for the originally scheduled hearing, did not leave a lot of time to review this, so I'm looking forward to the information to be presented in more detail and reading through it and what time has been available since it was made available to us. There are some things that I'm needing clarification on, and we do need to know that because, as the judge pointed out, our standard are the rates just and reasonable, not did we get everybody to finally compromise? And so I guess that's the information I'll be looking for this morning.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, good morning, everybody. I want to echo everybody else's applause for everyone who was involved and worked hard on this project, on this rate case, in the discussions. Gosh, there was a ton of information. I mean, it was really, really full and a really solid record. So that's the good thing. I want to make a special thanks to Walmart and the industrial customers for intervening. I always really appreciate having interveners in our cases. We have a really small staff. They're small but mighty, but we do our best with experts, but it's always helpful to get other parties looking at the information and bringing forward the issues that you all have so we can make sure that they're being addressed and considered. And so the fact that there have been a lot of different interests at the table looking at this and coming together and providing an agreement that everyone can live with, that's a big deal. And so the challenge is taking, you know, the reams of paper. It's always amazing to me when you can have just reams of paper that get consolidated into essentially 5 pages of terms. And I know it's 17 pages, but there's a lot of background and procedural history included in that, so we're not counting that. And so I'm left kind of going, what's missing, what wasn't addressed, trying to figure all that out. So I look forward to the discussion today to be able to get a better feel for where the give and take was specifically and what that means. So thanks, everyone, for your hard work, and looking forward to some solid discussions this morning.
And I just want to echo, as far as the settlement goes, you know, in reviewing the numbers of documents that were being dropped off at my office and the exhibits, I told my spouse many times that we weren't going anywhere this weekend because I don't think this hearing's going to get done in 3 days. And so, but pleasantly surprised. It obviously took a lot of work and a lot of negotiation between all the council, and that's greatly appreciated by all of us. Mr. Stephenson, you have some exhibits you want to stipulate into the record?
Yes, Your Honor. There is an exhibit list that is a joint exhibit list, and we have stipulated among the parties to admission of the items, which I will not go through given their volume, but I would ask that the exhibit list and all the exhibits contained therein be admitted.
Okay, and so you're moving the admission of not only the 50 OTP exhibits, but every party's exhibit?
I think we can, Your Honor.
Okay.
Unless there's an objection.
Okay. Mr. Pelham?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No.
Mr. Savickal?
None, thank you.
Mr. Wieczorek?
No objection.
Okay. In that case, I'm going to admit into the record Otter Tail Power exhibits 1 through 50, PSC exhibit. How many PSC exhibits do you have?
Six.
1 through 6. I'm not sure that I have that on this list. Oh, there they are. Okay. And MLEC exhibits 201, 202, 203, 204, and 205, and Walmart exhibit 1. So all of those stipulated exhibits are now part of the record and can be referred to without laying foundation for the exhibits. Mr. Stephenson, would you like to call your first witness?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Otter Tail Power calls Mr. Bruce Gerhardson.
Morning, Mr. Gerhardson. It's my duty, before you testify today, to inform you that under North Dakota law of the penalty for perjury. The penalty for perjury is up to 5 years in jail and possibly a $10,000 fine, and in some cases both can be assessed. I'll have you raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Stephenson.
Please state your name and full name for the record and your business address.
My full name is Bruce Gilbert Gerhardson, and my address is Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, 56537.
And what do you do for Otter Tail Power Company?
I'm the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs.
And, Mr. Gerhardson, is it your signature that appears on Otter Tail's application to increase or for authority to increase rates in this matter?
It is.
And have you filed testimony in this matter?
I have.
And, Mr. Gerhardson, have you authorized settlement in this matter on behalf of Otter Tail Power Company?
I have.
And have you prepared any materials to present to the Commission this morning in support of the settlement agreement?
I have. I have a PowerPoint presentation.
Okay. I'll note for the record that is marked as Exhibit Number 49. Are you prepared to present your materials, Mr. Gerhardson?
I am.
Please proceed.
Chair Christman and Commissioners, before I begin with the slides, I thought maybe the best thing to do would be start at the end. And if I were in your shoes, I might be most concerned with what is the ultimate rate increase that a residential customer might have. There's certainly other customers and other questions you'll have, but I thought maybe it'd be helpful to start at the end. when I penciled this out, I looked at the original request, and it indicated that we were requesting an $11.50 increase to an average residential customer. And so that, when I say average, it's the average consumption by a customer. There are customers who would consume more or less depending upon their circumstances. But based upon an average customer, we requested $11.50 increase. As you know, after we filed our application in November, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed and went into effect on January 1, 2018. So we reduced our interim rate request, and we reduced our interim rates and reduced our request. That reduced the request down to $10 for an average residential customer. When you get to the settlement, the amount that would be assessed to a residential customer would be $8. Now, each of these numbers, there's one additional factor that I think is important to take into consideration, and I'm going to explain that because some of the numbers on the slides will be, I think, clearer. And that's because we're rolling rider costs into base rates. Those are not going to be felt actually as increases to a customer in terms of their bill increasing. They're just moving from rider recovery to base rate recovery. So when I said the settlement will result in an $8 increase to a residential customer, the actual bill impact to a residential customer will be $5.50. I hope that that brief explanation about sort of what I think the end result of the rate case is, at least for a residential customer, will be helpful as I walk through these slides. So now I've tried to simplify it, so now I'll mess it up by complicating things with these slides. If you do have questions as I go through the slides, I would encourage you to interrupt me if that's helpful to you. I don't think we only have about 9 or 10 slides, so I don't think it'll go rather quickly. Carrie, if you could advance the slide deck. This first slide is really just a background. Many of these things you may know about Otter Tail, but there's a general depiction on the left-hand side of the slide of Otter Tail service territory and some of our important facilities and the locations that we serve. I think it's helpful sometimes to point out that we don't serve some areas of consequence within that footprint. That is, we don't serve the Fargo-Moorhead area, which would be just about central to the area. That's served by Xcel Energy and Cass County Electric. And then we also don't serve the Grand Forks area. But we do serve a very large area. It's about 70,000 square miles. But despite that very large geography, you may not be aware that we are the second smallest investor-owned utility in the country. We have 131,551 customers, 59,000 of which are in North Dakota. We serve exactly 245 communities in North Dakota. And it says our average population is about 400. So each community we serve is very small. Now, I'll point out, however, that in North Dakota, if I did the math right, the average population in North Dakota is a town of about 200. So we serve very small towns across this rural geography. We have about 800 employees, and we have about 800 megawatts of owned generation. We also have generation that we purchase through power purchase agreements. We have about 245 megawatts of wind generation. I believe every bit of it is located in the state of North Dakota. And we have about 5,800 miles of transmission lines around this territory. Maybe it's worth pointing out, too, that our large baseload units, Coyote in Beulah and Big Stone in Big Stone, South Dakota, are shared units with other utilities, but Otter Tail is the operator of those facilities. Maybe I'll move on to the next slide. Our request. This is where I hope that beginning description might help to kind of unpack a couple of the numbers. In November, we filed an application and requested a $13.1 million increase to revenue. The request was a $15.7 million increase, but the $13.1 million reduces that amount by the amount that would have already been collected through riders. So the effective increase was requested was $13.1 million, which is an 8.72 effective increase. In February, we reduced our interim rate collections to reflect the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And on March, in March, we also revised the rate request downward to reflect the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and some other adjustments provide the most up-to-date information. For example, our pension costs had decreased, so we decreased the amount of pension cost recovery in the rate case. Adjustments we made through the rebuttal testimony reduced the request to $7.5 million, which is, again, $10.1 million less the rider, the amounts associated with the riders. And that results in a just a little over a 5% effective increase requested at that time. And the settlement results in an effective $5.6 million increase. Again, that's net of the rider recoveries being adjusted. And that amounts to a 3.76% effective increase. There's a lot of numbers on this page, so I have a thought it might be useful to pause and say, do you have any questions here? We can come back to it, too, if that's useful. Going on to slide number four.
Judge, do you want to do questions like that where we can jump in, or how do you want to proceed?
I would say feel free. We could do it that way, or we can just wait until.
Are you okay with that,
Brian?
I'm going to wait. I could ask questions. I'm going to wait.
Yeah, we can follow the usual protocol, okay. But if something jumps out at you and you really feel the need to, go ahead.
Well, since we're on this page, well, now we're not, but can you elaborate on the difference between the $7.4 million and the $5.6 million? Just what comes out? Less the rider reductions. So where did... Just clarify that again. I'm losing track of those numbers.
No, I appreciate that. And that is, I think, one of the first things that if I were in your shoes, I'd want to understand. And so the $7.5 million that you're asking about, is that in that fourth bullet point? Is that the one you're asking about?
Yeah, $7.4 million.
There's also a $7.4 million, which is in the final bullet point, which is the number that's referenced in the settlement agreement. That may be what you're asking about.
Yeah.
Why don't I start there, and if we have questions, we can work back from there.
Yeah, that's the increase less the rider.
The $7.4 million does not take into consideration that Otter Tail reduced its rider recoveries to an amount to reflect the lower rate of return and the lower amount of jurisdictional allocations. So the starting point becomes lower. So we'll get to one of the last slides in this slide deck. I'll actually do a little bit of a walkthrough for each of the rates in the rate class. So when we look at the percentages that you will see increased for each class, they are from a point where we've already reduced the rider recoveries for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, for example. So if you were asked by a customer, how does this change my rates from what I was paying in December? The correct number is the 3.76% effective increase. So if they said after this increase, compared to what I was paying in December, the number is 3.76% or the $5.6 million increase.
And the two things you mentioned was the reduced return ROE on the riders, and there was one other thing.
We changed the jurisdictional allocators. Oh. That's how we divide the cost recoveries between the three states that we serve and FERC as an additional jurisdiction, but this is primarily a change to the state, the amounts you pay in North Dakota.
Very good. Thank you, Bruce.
And that is, I think, one of the, if you can understand that, that will be one of the most helpful things, I think, in understanding the settlement and the case. It's the moving parts that I think it'll help illustrate it as we get to the back of the deck, where I can show you that there's a step we take, and then we increase. And that first step is actually a reduction to some of the recoveries we make following the filing related to the riders. Then we have the increase, and so if you did a December to current, it's that effective increase number. Okay, slide four. What drove the need for a rate case? Primarily, the need for a rate case was driven by the fact that we haven't had a change to our base rate since 2008, and that was based on a 2007 test year, so it's been 10 years. And since that time, we've made significant infrastructure investments and investments in technology. I think it's impressive that our company has increased its plant in service for the benefit of our customers by twofold. We've doubled the amount of investment that we have serving our customers over that period. So as we look at some rate slides later, one thing that's really interesting to highlight is, despite that, our rates have gone up very little. Our operation and maintenance expense costs that are not recovered in any other way have increased, obviously, over those 10 years. And we have had changes in our production tax credits. That is, our production tax credits on wind facilities are only provided for 10 years. So we get a tax credit for 10 years, and then while the wind farms continue to produce energy, the production tax credits stop. There were some other tax-related benefits that ended in 2017 that are, for the most part, associated with some of the infrastructure investments that we made and depreciation associated with that. And then the final bullet point there, our revenues haven't kept up with costs. Our sales increased just 2.5% since 2008, and that's cumulative. So we had about a quarter of a percent each year over those 10 years. So while costs have increased at a faster rate than that, our sales just haven't kept up to keep up with those cost increases. Next slide, I think. This is to show you Otter Tail's history of low rates. We are the blue line. The other utilities serving in North Dakota are the other color lines. You'll see that we've had very stable rates over the entire period. This goes from 2011 through December of 2017, which is really the last date. And I guess today you're deciding what happens thereafter. The blue line shows a couple of things. One, it's been very consistent over the entire period. As I mentioned, the doubling of our rate base was since 2007. I think the majority of it occurred during this period, but the rates have certainly not gone up that much. The other thing to mention is we are, of course, the lowest cost provider of any investor-owned utility in the state of North Dakota by quite a bit. And I should point out that this slide incorporates all rates charged to our customers and all rates charged to other utilities' customers. That means this is inclusive of base rates, riders, fuel clause, everything. So this is really bill-to-bill comparison. And it is aggregated for all types of customers. This particular slide, the next one will be residential only, but this one is averaged across all customer classes. The next slide, I think. Now, this is just a singling out residential to residential comparison. You'll see very similar kinds of differences here. You'll see that Otter Tail has had very stable rates over that fairly lengthy period, and that Otter Tail has, by comparison, the lowest residential rates in the state of North Dakota by quite a margin. Even after this rate increase, pursuant to the settlement, our rates will remain the lowest in the state of North Dakota. And for all classes in aggregate and for the residential rate class. I think we can move on to slide seven. One thing that we've highlighted in the record in this case is our superior performance over these periods. Otter Tail is recognized as meeting its customer expectations. J.D. Power has began to include Otter Tail in its studies. I believe it was in 2015. Before that, they didn't assess utilities as small as Otter Tail, but they began doing so in 2015. And in each period since then through 2017, Otter Tail has been in the top three in the Midwest mid-size region. The American Customer Satisfaction Index supports the findings of J.D. Power. We score significantly above the average scores of other utilities in every rating category. And what I mean by rating category here is that irrespective of the type of utility, so we are compared very favorably against other investor-owned utilities, other cooperatives, and municipal utilities. We have been awarded by the Edison Electric Institute an emergency recovery award for outstanding restoration efforts. These were specifically the Christmas winter storm in 2016 Christmas, I believe, that was awarded then in 2017 for restoration efforts in North Dakota and South Dakota. Regulatory Research Associates identified us as the fourth lowest price provider among utilities with parent companies in the nation. So we're proud of our achievements, which we think should be amplified because of our small size. The next slide continues on a bit of a description of some of our successes. You may be aware, I'm sure you're aware, that we put in the largest single infrastructure investment in the company's history when we included or added air quality control systems to our Big Stone plant in Big Stone, South Dakota. As I mentioned, Otter Tail is the operator of that plant. We chose to become the construction manager for that project, which was a bit unusual. I think a lot of utilities would have hired a contractor on a full engineer procure and construct basis, but Otter Tail felt it had the expertise and the familiarity with the plant and could marshal the resources to serve in that role. By doing so, we were able to reduce the cost of that project, and the project was completed $128 million under budget, which is a 26% saving under the budget. That budget was extensively reviewed in an advanced determination of proceeding in front of the commission prior to its construction. Those savings have all been passed on to Otter Tail customers, and they will continue for the 30-year life of that project. In 2018 alone, Otter Tail's North Dakota customers will pay $3 million less because of the cost savings we had on that project. So it's a very significant achievement. It's where utilities really can differentiate themselves, I think, is when they can complete infrastructure projects successfully. I'll point out that even MDU's customers will pay lower rates because of our success, because they are one of the shared owners in that project. We'll move on to the settlement on page 9. The key terms, again, we'll get into some of these percentages and numbers that I hope are getting more clear. So the effective increase to our customers under the settlement is $5.6 million. So if, again, compared to what a customer or customers were paying in December, compared to what they're going to pay after the settlement approval, it's $5.6 million or 3.76%. The reason the $7.4 million and the 5.03% shows up in the settlement agreement will be explained a little bit more on the next slide, but it has to do with that it doesn't include that we have already reduced the recoveries under the riders to match the ROE and the jurisdictional allocators that I mentioned. The settlement reflects a 9.77% return on equity. The expense recoveries that we requested in our application have been reduced by $1.4 million through the settlement negotiations. And revenue allocations and rate design have been agreed upon that better reflect our costs of service to each of our customer classes. And I know at least Commissioner Krosh has had questions on that, and I'll hopefully be able to explain some of the reasons that we made some changes there that we think will be beneficial over the long term. The next slide is a busy slide, and I apologize for it, but I'll try and use this to both illustrate this walk forward that I talked about of what was being paid in December versus what we expect under the settlement and why the percentages are sort of at a second step. And then I'll also can focus on a few of the rate classes that you probably care about. So first of all, What we've got here is all of our major customer classes. They're listed down the right-hand, the left-hand column. And then we have their monthly usage. So the monthly usage there is for a typical customer of that class. If we looked at all of our customers and said, what's an average customer in that class using, that kilowatt hours are represented there. Different customers, of course, use more or less, and that means the numbers from there on would be different for them. But for a typical customer, we can do some comparisons.
Are these North Dakota customers?
These are North Dakota only. So they are, do not. They only include the North Dakota customers. There's no information here that relates to our Minnesota or South Dakota customers. So the first column that you see is the pre-filing monthly bill of one of those customers. So you'll see, and I'll use residential as probably the best example for you. They would have been paying a bill of about $84.86. After we made our application, which is an application to change base rates, we also changed our rider recoveries to represent the requested ROE and jurisdictional allocators that we were requesting in the case. They were lower than what had previously been approved. And so that number goes down. So the second column is really the reflects a change to the rider recoveries to make them a bit lower. And that becomes the starting point for what do we want as a change to base rates. So in the settlement, we start with the $83.84, not with the $84.86, because you've already approved the rider reductions. So then we get to the settlement increase, which is the settlement annual percent increase. The 899 is the residential customer increase. It is an increase from the 883.84. That increases the typical monthly bill to $91.38, and that's the change in the monthly bill under the settlement, the $7.54. But it is a somewhat lower number if we consider the December to our request, and it's because that rider change has already occurred. I have probably confused you, but we can come back to it. The other information on that slide is really just the same information for each of the rate classes that we have listed there. The slide number 11 is really just a summary slide. We believe our extensive record has demonstrated that the settlement that we're asking that you approve today is just and reasonable. It's our first rate increase from a general rate case in 10 years. We've demonstrated a record of superior utility performance. That performance has resulted in significant cost savings for our North Dakota customers. Our rates remain the lowest on average in North Dakota. And our revenue allocations and rate design better reflect our costs of service to those classes. With that, I believe my presentation is concluded, and you can maybe ask me questions.
We'll go to Mr. Stephenson. Any other questions for Mr. Gerhardsen?
No, Your Honor. We would tender this witness for questions.
Mr. Pelham.
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Go last.
Okay. Mr. Savicko.
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Wieczorek.
No questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Back to you.
Okay. I do have one question. Let's look at that last slide with the rates in it. Or next, not in last, but third to the last or whatever. Once or twice when you were talking about the change, the already approved change to the riders, you mentioned the rate of return and the tax act. And then once or twice toward the end, you mentioned the rate of return and the jurisdictional allocation. So is it all three? Were all three in those rider reductions, or just two of them?
This is subject to check. I believe all three.
Okay. That's all I had at this point.
Hey, questions from the commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
I'm just going to start with, I think, the question that a lot of people will ask, and for me anyway, it's going to, we'll get into more detail with some of the other questions I have, but in 2017, return on equity for Otter Tail was, I believe, 9.44%. Is that correct?
I believe somewhere around 9.4 would have been what was reported in our 2017 actual earnings to North Dakota.
And that was without the benefits of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, correct?
That would have reflected no Tax Cuts and Jobs Act because that didn't come into being
right
until January 1 of 18.
Right. So that wasn't reflected. That will be reflected going forward. So what is the argument that you would make, having a pretty good return on equity, mm-hmm, and now that's should be enhanced going forward, so why would we have to do anything?
There's several reasons. Number one, with respect to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as you know, we reflected that in the interim rate recoveries, and we have taken that out of our proposal. So that in and of itself wouldn't change Otter Tail's earnings. In other words, we're giving all of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act impact back to our customers. So there's nothing left over for the company to change its earnings position. Secondly, we have had several things that have occurred to our cost of service that occurred rather abruptly in 2018. One of the things was the expiration of the production tax credits on the wind farms that were constructed in 2007 and 2008. So the production tax credits puts pressure on our recoveries, and that changes our rate of return unless we get a recovery through this increase. We also had a large investment in a CIS-1 project, our customer information system project that goes into service during this time frame. That increases our need for recovery. And there's a number of other things that change in 2008 that would reduce our earnings substantially, and that's what the increase is meant to cover.
Can you explain your capital expenditure program? From 2012 to 2016, it was at $672 million, is what is reported in the settlement agreement on page 4 of 17. And I would call it the second sentence of the second paragraph.
Yes.
And going forward from 2017 to 2021, that number will change from, or go to 862, or a difference of 190 million. So from a trending standpoint, why would, or can you explain why there will be an additional 47.5 million over the 4 years moving forward in comparison to the 2012 to 2016 time period?
The investments
just
that
some
we've...
bullet points on that.
Yes. Chair Christmas and Commissioner Crotchis, the what's occurred in the past, it has included wind farms, I think, during that period. Oh, I have to take that back. Let's see what period. 2012. That would have included the investments, for example, in the Big Stone AQCS project, some large transmission projects that we're building in North and South Dakota, the Big Stone, sometimes referred to as the Big Stone area transmission projects. Going forward, the 862 of additional million will be made in I think it's planned for the Maricourt Wind Project and the Astoria Gas Plant Project, each of which have been approved by the Commission in an advanced determination of prudence proceeding. There are other projects within there, but those are the ones that are driving those numbers. So these numbers of the amount of investment don't typically remain on a consistent trajectory for any utility. Utilities tend to build large projects. That's why we need the kinds of capital that our utilities need. That's why we need recovery from you. So we have and have been in a large infrastructure construction period. We expect to continue on that for the next several years at least. And there is, I think, a really helpful illustration, which might be in my direct testimony if we want to get to more detail, but maybe I'll just leave it there. And if you'd like more detail, I would direct you there.
So on page 4 of your PowerPoint, you have PTCs and other tax-related benefits ended in 2017, but when you cite Mericourt, you'll be receiving production tax credits from Mericourt, correct?
That is correct, or that's our expectation right now, yes.
So in terms of those particular benefits ending, there will be a new set going 10 years.
We will get...
Forward 10 years.
Correct. Those are not... we'll have to make additional investment to be in a position to get those production tax credits. They are figured into our expenditure plans in the future, but it doesn't put us back to where we were prior to the expiration on the old wind farms, because we have to continue to cover the capital costs of those wind farms as our customers continue to use them through their entire life.
Does the majority of the $190 million increase in capital expenditures, does that, generally speaking, tie back to replacing the Hoot Lake facility with the Astoria and Mericourt projects?
It likely does. There are some other things in it, and I want to be clear about it. It's not an increase of 100. It's not that we will invest $190 million. It's that we'll invest $862 million, which is more than we invested over the prior period referenced on that page that you cited.
Right,
so it's a fairly big jump, but yeah.
It's $190 million. It's $100 increase, correct, between
right.
the first four, in 2012 to 2016 versus?
Correct. And actually, the majority of the $862 million, I believe, relates to the Mericourt Wind Farm and the maybe I'm reading these things wrong. The Mericourt Wind Farm and the Astoria project.
One of my questions, and then I see it on the PowerPoint, and I think it depends on what column you want to look at, but on page 10 of the PowerPoint that you just presented, one of the questions I had was when I looked at the original filing and I was looking at the different rate classes, energy charges, my math showed a savings that large commercial, large general service customers would actually pay less than they had had previously. And I think that's reflected in the pre-filing monthly bill comparison. So they're actually, you could argue, well, they're certainly paying less than they did pre-filing, or they would be going forward under this settlement. And then residential is going up, and you've cited trying to correct, to some degree, an imbalance. How far does this get you? Does it get you halfway there? And I know that's a really general question, but how far does this advance that rebalancing, if you will?
Chair Christman and Commissioner Karashas, it's a great question, and it's something that we looked at carefully, and I think there was actually an illustration that might help us to see that. And what it will do is it'll include, I believe we have an illustration that includes the cost of service study numbers. That would be as if you were going to go straight to cost, what the numbers would be. So this will show you how close we get, I think. Do I have that illustration? Am I remembering things correctly? And I think if Mr. Stephenson could maybe offer that as an additional exhibit, that might help illustrate the occurrence.
Thanks.
Thank you.
that
Mr. Gerhardsen, can you identify the exhibit?
Is your mic on?
It is not. Mr. Gerhardsen, can you identify what I've put before you?
Yes, what's been marked as Exhibit 51 is an identification of the class allocations and the settlement revenue apportionment compared to the class cost of service study, the CCOSS, and the original proposed revenue apportionment by Otter Tail.
And is this the illustration that you were previously referring to?
It is.
And was this prepared at, by you or at your direction?
It was.
We'd offer OTP Exhibit 51.
Okay. Any objections, Mr. Pelham?
No objection.
Mr. Savickal?
None, Your Honor.
Mr. Wieczorek, I don't know if you know exactly what the exhibit looks like, but...
I'm familiar with the illustration, Your Honor, so I have no objections.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I have no objection. I wondered if anyone was emailing the Walmart attorney these new things that come up through the hearing. If somebody with their computer was willing to do that from Otter Tail, that would probably be a helpful thing.
Okay. All right. Then I'm going to admit OTP Exhibit 51 is what we're going to call this. And you may proceed.
Chair Christman and Commissioner Crotchis, the let me just walk through what this is for the record and maybe for some helpful explanation. What we have here is essentially some of the information that is included on slide 10. Not all of the information, in fact. The starting point really is the numbers from the settlement agreement. So we start with column, the settlement annual percent increase column on the slide 10 from the deck, that 8.99%. But what we do show is the original class cost of service study responsibility. That would be the folks that did the economic analysis to determine what each class of customers within Otter Tail's customer groups, what they should pay of the total of the revenue deficiency. And then the final is what we originally proposed for each class to get when we filed our application, which, of course, was back in November. But you're correct that the settlement percent increase here does not fully reflect the December to current under the proposal, and that would go to a slight reduction. But the original class cost of service study showed that the large general service was currently subsidizing the other classes by as much as 2.5%. So while it doesn't get us all the way there, it gets us part of the way there. It has been my experience that it's rare to get all the way there in a single rate case, but that it's important to do one's best to get as far as one can to remove subsidies between classes and get them closer to cost of service. That was a long answer, and I hope this illustration helps to illustrate why did the company think this was appropriate and results in just and reasonable rates. It's because of that.
All right. I'll have to review it in more detail. I could study for 5 minutes, but it would be an awkward silence, so I won't do that.
And I assume talking for 5 minutes, if I talked for 5 minutes, it wouldn't help either.
Well, it was helpful when you were talking. I was able to peruse this a little bit more, but I was listening. So, I'll be honest, I still have to take a really hard look at what is the appropriate balance or rebalancing, if you will, in terms of how different overall how things are allocated in this. Did you, you know, and I struggled with this personally when I was looking at the increase in terms for farms and for irrigation. You know, I know realistically, well, we know commodity prices are low, but realistically, is that fair reasoning in terms of softening on those? And I see on the change in monthly bill under the settlement, you know, when you look at that collectively and multiply those numbers by 12, it's not quite as bad as when I just look at the percentages. But just, I guess, just thinking out loud, that was a thought that I did have. And then I had one other question for you at this time. Just so I have my math correct, the original request was $13.1 million.
That sounds correct, yes. $13.1 million.
Okay, $13.1 million, and then after the TCJA impact, that reduced that by $5.6 million down to $7.5
million. I think it depends on which number we start with. There's a $15 million number that is...
Well, I'm putting the riders to the side.
Okay.
The impact of changes to the riders. So going to 13.1, which actually was the net number, I believe you stated in your
right
on page 3 of your PowerPoint. 13.1 million increase in revenue. That was the 15.7 less rider reductions to ROE and allocation factors.
Correct.
Okay, and then the TCJA reduced that number by $5.6 million, so went from 13.1 to 7.5, correct?
The 7.5, I think if we start with the 13.1, we would not include all of that to get to the 7.5, all of the $4.5 million or $5 million to the TCJA. I don't know if I have that step change here. There is a bit more that is also decreased, and it really changes. Yes, there's a little bit more than the TCJA to get us there. There is some change to the pension costs.
Okay. But in the end, the settlement results in an effective $5.6 million increase.
That is correct.
So... is another way of looking at this that in terms of the original ask under the settlement, you would be getting all but $1.9 million of it?
I would have to do the math. That may, it's probably in that neighborhood. If it's not $1.9 million, it's a couple million. But I'm not sure if we'd be getting all of it is exactly the right way to look at that. Because we've already, for good reason, understood, given all of the difference between the $13.1 million and the $5.6 million. Ultimately, by giving the changes to the pension costs, for example, and resolving many of the other issues even before the $7.5 million, there wasn't that much left in dispute, I suppose. There was a fair amount of reduction to expenses and a change to the return on equity.
And then somewhere in the settlement agreement, the terminology competitiveness, and I believe it was brought up during opening comments, competitiveness in terms of rate. So in terms of, just to clarify, so that's not misinterpreted, nobody else is going to come in and provide that service to those customers, correct? So it's not as if you're competing because it's a monopoly situation. That is your market.
Chair Christman and Commissioner Crosius, that is correct. We're not in a competitive environment here. These are for customers that take service on within our service territory or through a PCNN that you have granted.
So it really relates back to the graphs that you showed in terms of, I just want to clarify that because I think it seemed a little misleading in terms of, and maybe that's not the best word, but I don't think it was as clear as it could have been in terms of describing that.
Chair Christman and Commissioner Crotchis, I think that the word was used by Mr. Savakul, and I think it's a commonly used word by he and his customers, some of which have more than one location of facility, and they look at competitiveness to some degree in that totality of circumstances. And let me give you an example and why it matters for us and for his group. If one of his customers had two locations and one of them was less competitive with its other facility in another location, if they were choosing to possibly expand one of their facilities or even contract, they would do so with the less competitive. And so that's just an example of how that term could be used, where it doesn't suggest we're creating a competition in an industry that doesn't provide for competition. So I think he's using it in that more generic sense.
But for a large national-based chain, or even global,
we got a great.
The rates are extremely good in comparison to other parts of the country.
Chair Christman and Commissioner Crotchis, it gets difficult to evaluate to a degree, especially when you get into the large industrial group, because to some degree, some parts of the country have very, very, very large industrials as compared to the type of industrial customer we might serve. But we do know that as we look at our competitiveness, just from a simple understanding of the classes, we are a very competitive utility. In fact, we are the lowest cost provider if we think of competitive in the sense that Mr. Savakul is using, meaning that people would like to have low rates. Our residential customers, as I mentioned, pay the lowest rates in the state. What I think Mr. Savakul is pointing out is that our customers in his customer group have not been as low as the other rate classes relative to national averages. And maybe I should have him speak for himself, but that's what I think the point that he has tried to make with the idea of competitive rates.
So on your PowerPoint, you have a graph on page 5, North Dakota rate comparisons. That's all customers, bill data. So that's everything rolled up into one, correct?
Correct.
And then you have the North Dakota residential rate comparison on the next slide, page 6. Do you have a slide for large general?
We do have that data, and let me find out if we have.
I would like to see that. That would be helpful to get a better idea of what we're talking about in terms of competitiveness.
Yep. I think that we may have that. I'll look to the choir to see if they.
Okay, because that does get back to the crux of one of my concerns in terms of.
It'll just take me a minute to get that, and I think I can anticipate some of what it'll show. It will show, I think, that Otter Tail is more in the mix of the other investor-owned utilities. It may be that we are not the lowest provider amongst the large industrial group. And I think that it'll show that the national averages for that large group are closer to what we are seeing our customers pay. But I will point out that some of those differences likely relate to the large, you could imagine, in the Great Lakes region where you've got, very large aluminum manufacturing type plants that have enormous consumption. Their load factors and other things drive their per unit cost way down for kilowatt hours. So there's some amount of interference from that I would think we'll see. And it'll just be a moment. I'm trying to stall.
Few minutes.
We can get back to that.
We'll come back to that if that's okay.
At this point, I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Christman.
Well, Mr. Gerhardsen, I appreciate your courteous formality, but this is North Dakota, so you don't have to address me on every question.
Okay.
Presiding officer, especially in this case, since I'm not presiding and we have a Judge Ward that presiding. So we're not addressing our questions to the judge, so okay. It's fine. I think I'm asking probably the same questions as Commissioner Crosius on the first couple, but we all need to be able to
we do that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Follow the shells and mm-hmm. figure out where the ball is here. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. when we reduced the interim rate from $12.8 million to $8.3 million, a $4.5 million reduction because of the Jobs, the Tax Cuts and Jobs mm-hmm. Act, did that $4.5 million turn out to be accurate? Or somewhere here I see something that indicates it maybe ends up being a little bit more than that. What is the number that is that impact?
Commissioner Christman, I don't know that I know that myself sitting right here. I do think that it was at the time we made the interim adjustment an estimate of what we expected it to be during the interim rate period. And I would be surprised if we were exactly accurate, so I'll see if somebody has the exact number.
Well, it seems to me before we can ever finish comparing the settlement number with the original $13.1 million request, we have to know what that number is, because that number mm-hmm. is, in fairness, really needs to be added to the increase in the settlement to show what the increased revenues to the company is going to be, correct?
Commissioner Christman, I think actually I should back up and talk about two different things. One would be the amount of the TCJA adjustment during the interim rate period, and then the amount of the TCJA that goes into the final rates. I believe this is the case, and subject to check with my economic staff, we do the because the test year was 2017, which was prior to the TCJA. I have to think about this. No, I take that back. It's 2018. My belief is that we calculate the effect of the TCJA based upon all of the adjustments that would be included in the final settlement. So we do know that number because that becomes a known amount of income, and we know what our income tax obligations are on that known amount of final rates income. I do believe that the amount in the interim rate period has to be calculated for purposes of the interim rate refund on a different basis, if I make myself clear. So we do know the amount that would be included in the final rates, and it's based upon whatever the outcome would be. Taxes will be determined based upon the amount of income assumed in the test year, but the interim rate period is handled a little bit differently.
Okay, well, I will want that number as for the
okay.
the ongoing number, because yep. to compare the 13.1 with the 5.6, that number needs to be in that equation in my mind. So on slide 4, you mentioned that net plant and service has doubled since the 2007 test year. And so my question was, give me the handful of the largest investments based on your answer to one of Commissioner Crassus's questions, which I think is the same one, is the answer to that the AQCS at Big Stone, the Maricourt project, and the Astoria project?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the biggies in this.
Commissioner Christman, the AQCS project is complete. The Astoria project is a project we plan for the future.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But they are both big projects. Part of the numbers that we were going through about our increasing rate base or net plant in service, I'll sort of use those terms interchangeably. Those are the AQCS plant would be the largest in our recent past, and the Astoria project would be one of the big ones that we look forward to.
In the recent past, since the 2007 test year, what are the big handful, I'll let you cut off the number, of projects that caused the plant in service to double? So we got the AQCS.
And Commissioner Christman, there is a illustration in my direct testimony, and I'm going to go from memory here, but largely it's going to be, since 2007 at least, it would be three major wind farms we constructed in North Dakota. It would be the AQCS project. It would be the Big Stone area transmission projects and the CapEx transmission projects. I'm probably forgetting something, but they are generally identified, I think, on that illustration. Both the past and the expected future.
Okay. And then to be clear, slides 5 and 6, are the rates reflected for Otter Tail Power in those graphs? Current rates, the 2017 rates, or is that what the rates will be if this settlement is adopted?
The rates on slide 5 are the rates current through December of 2017, which is effectively when we filed the case, and prior back to 2011. It does not reflect the increase of this case. One could...
If everything else stays still, where will Otter Tail Power be on this scale after this?
We would be, I believe the answer is about half a cent higher. Let me get that one moment. There are a few things that are moving that make this a little bit, because of the loss of the PTCs, which will be reflected, and I might have to say subject to check, but I think it would be about, if we are at 8 and 28.2, we might be up to 9 on that, might be up to 8.2. I'd have to have somebody calculate it because it's a gross number, but I think we would be up by about 5% from that number. I mean, rough terms.
So you expect you'd still be the cheapest of the four, but like much closer to XL then?
Somewhat closer, and... Yeah, somewhat closer, but still I would say a good margin lower.
Okay, and then slide 6, you were right at about 9, and what will this take that residential rate to?
I believe it would be under 10. I believe, and I'd have to have subject to check on that, but it should be under 10. But above 9.
Do get back to me if either of those are wrong. Otherwise, we'll just go by what you said here. Then I'm jumping to slide 10 and those irrigation rates. It's up dramatically, and aren't most of your irrigation customers on interruptible service?
Yes, sure.
And let me just finish the question. And so doesn't that make them really nice loads to have? And so it would seem like they shouldn't need to go up so dramatically.
Chair Chrisman, one of the things that happens with this class irrigation is it's super small, meaning the number of kilowatt hours we sell to anybody that fits within the irrigation class is very small. So the total, the aggregate amount of proposed revenues is $66,000, whereas the other classes are, you know, $50 million. So it gets to be something of an anomaly in this analysis. And what happens is, I think some of the rate design folks could tell you, I don't know if it's interruptible, but it's very intermittent, seasonally and, you know, in any other periodicity. So the cost to serve for the times you're going to pump irrigation is a relatively small number of hours during the total number of hours in a year. So stringing the wires and all the things that are necessary to provide service at that location, I think, tend to be costly compared on a, you know, when we think of it at a per kilowatt hour basis. And so these kinds of moves can occur, I think, abruptly.
So the intermittency is obvious, but I would have assumed they were interruptible too.
I don't know that they are, because an interruptible load, and I'd have to have my more folks who know more about this, an interruptible load requires actually some additional infrastructure to make it interruptible. We have to be able to send a signal to shut it off or allow it to be turned on. I don't believe that occurs with irrigation loads, so I don't believe they're interruptible. But I would have to say that is my understanding, and those some of the folks over here know way more about that than I do. They're not shaking their head? They stop shaking their head? Thank you. I wish I had a little mirror to see what they're doing. I can't look at them and you at the same time. Yeah.
So on the existing older wind farms where the PTCs are expiring now, so the cost of building them is being spread over how many years? Is it 25 or 30?
My recollection, Commissioner, is 25 years.
And the point of that is because you expect to get energy generated for that long, and the customers in the 24th year should be paying for it, just like the customers in the 5th year.
Correct, Commissioner.
So aren't we really from a just a theoretical standpoint doing this wrong by not spreading the PTCs out over the same amount of time? Mm-hmm. Because the people that have maybe are moving away now, mm-hmm. and have only mm-hmm. worked the first 10 years, only received benefits of that project for the first 10 years, paid far less for their power than the people who will be just signing up in the next years, mm-hmm. and paying in the last 60% of the time frame. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I think it's a great observation. When we first began recoveries on the wind farms, we actually had that very question with the commission and commission staff, probably more appropriately. The decision, we actually advocated to apply the benefit of the tax, the production tax credits, the same way we do for accelerated depreciation. That is, spread it out over the life of the projects. But it was decided by staff and the commission that we should do it on a flow-through basis. That is, while the PTCs are generated, we give credit to customers. And actually, there's a thing I'd like to highlight, if you don't mind, that's quite beneficial to current customers, and that is that we even when we can't use the production tax credits on a tax return, because we may have other tax deductions related to other investments. We reflect them in the rates. So they do had been receiving those as they were generated by the wind farms. But as a policy matter, there was not a normalization violation that we could identify for taking the production tax credits as they were generated, and the commission preferred to take them as they were generated rather than spread them over the expected life of the farms.
Does this settlement case make that decision for Americord?
It doesn't. That could be done differently
for
Americord. That remains
to be, that's a decision that remains to be made later, correct?
That is correct.
I don't have any more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Fedorchak.
Judge, I might propose we take a break.
Okay.
And then start with my questions after that.
Okay, we can do that. Let's take a break until about 22.
Perfect. Mostly because I need to.
Yeah, that doesn't.
I need another bottle.
Thank you. Sure.
Okay, back on the record, Mr. Gerhardt, Gerhardson, just a reminder, you're still under oath. Commissioner Fedorchak, questions for Mr. Gerhardson?
I do. I'm trying to do this in a way that makes sense, but I'm just going to have to jump around. So, in this chart that you brought out, In response to one of Commissioner Crotius's questions, what I'd like to see that I don't think I'm seeing here is once you apply the new rates, how does each class contribute to their cost of service? What's their percentage? Because wouldn't that show how far we've come in equalizing and getting rid of the huge gap in the contributions that the large general service is making as compared to residential? Do we have a chart like that?
We have the information in the chart in my PowerPoint on page 10.
Okay.
Slide 10. And so just to clarify for the record, what we're looking at is Exhibit 51, and what you've identified correctly is that the proposed I take it back, that is here, the settlement percent increase.
That's just their bill increase though, isn't it?
Are you asking then how close are we to their actual cost of service?
Right.
Yes, we don't have that information either on slide 10 or on Exhibit 51. I believe that's information we could get.
Okay. I think that would be helpful just so that we ultimately, that gets to the question I think Commissioner Crotius was asking in terms of how much of that gap are we closing and you know, how much is each class contributing to their, you know, their cost.
Commissioner Fedorchak, there is a way, it's relatively simple math, that if you take on Exhibit 51 the settlement percent increase column,
mm-hmm.
and you subtract it from the original C costs responsibility column.
Which is which one?
The third column, or fourth. The original, I'm sorry, on Exhibit 51, not in my slide 10. So the other,
oh, this one.
The other illustration. So if you take the settlement percent increase and you subtract it from the original cost responsibility column, mm-hmm. you'd be left with what remains. So, for example, you have the 8.99. You subtract that from the 22.08, and that's how far you would remain away from cost. Because if we, if that number equaled zero, mm-hmm. you would be at cost. If you were to subtract what's in column,
okay,
that okay. column from the one in the next column, you would, if you got to zero, you would equal cost. So the difference between those two is what is going to be
remaining. The
remaining.
And the ideal number that we're trying to get that person. So if you did the math a different way, and I can't even begin to tell you how, but I know there's a formula for getting to what the cost. Isn't that number 7.64%? What is the goal?
I have to correct my earlier comments. I don't think it's as simple as subtracting the one column from the other now that I think about it. So
okay.
I will make that subject a check. I don't think if they were, I think if they were all 10.61, I think we have to subtract that number.
Okay, well, you're confusing me, so don't even talk about it.
I just want to withdraw my comment about, I don't think it's as simple as subtracting those two, but we will have somebody do that math. I just wanted to correct it before I got too far on that.
Very good. I'll ignore that, and then you guys can just do the math with the new rates in the settlement and show where each class is in terms of its contribution to cost. That would
we'll
be
do.
That would be great. Okay. Earlier in our discussion here, you talked about when I asked about the difference between the 7.4 million increase, and then you applied some different changes to the riders and came up with the 5 point something total, like effective increase, right? Revenue increase.
Correct.
You talked about applying reduced return on equity on the riders and changed jurisdictional allocators. What are those?
The jurisdictional allocators, I assume.
Or how did they change? I mean, I don't recall reading a lot about that or a proposal to do that, so I need to help. I need to better understand how that's being handled here.
The jurisdictional allocators are described by Mr. Tomerdahl in his testimony. I think there's some extensive discussion, I believe, in his direct testimony. That's my memory, at least. It may be in someone else's. If it is, I apologize. The ultimately, it is that we allocate costs not only we do it in two major steps. One is amongst our jurisdictions, and one is then amongst the classes. To a large extent, it's meant to be cost causation, principles of cost causation, and cost causation is largely dependent upon consumption. Mm-hmm. So we would look at several factors, but the two most important are just how much energy is being consumed and how much demand the group of customers is putting on the system. There are other factors like customer per customer count, kinds of factors for what's the cost of our billing or something, because any regardless of your size, you get a bill and it costs about as much to produce it. But most of our costs are either demand or energy. So when we look at a test year in a rate case, we look at what are the relative demands and energy consumptions within our three states, and those result in the percentage of costs that will be borne by each state. In this period, the relative amount of energy consumed in Minnesota went up, partly because of some pipeline consumption, is my understanding, and that caused North Dakota rates to, in a sense, be positively meant, meaning the costs would go down relative to the total. I believe that's.
And do you only make those changes during a rate case?
Generally, we make them only during a rate case.
Okay. And do you need approval by the other jurisdictions to change them?
We get that approval in the next rate case in that jurisdiction. So there is a little bit of a sort of a moving around to get that reset. They generally change in the small partial percentages or single-digit type percentages. Okay. We generally see growth equitably across the system, except for once in a while, like we have recently with pipeline loads having a little more consumption, is my understanding.
Very good. So this gap between the industrial customers and the residential customers, which the company hasn't disputed, Commissioner Crosses was asking for a chart. Does the company agree with the one included in the MLEX testimony on page 12 of, Cavitamani, this chart?
I will have to look at that. I don't specifically recall it. So if you don't mind, I'll take one moment.
Sure. I mean, you can just take mine for now.
I can verify it against some information that we have. I don't disagree that we are for that particular class of customers above the national average. I think, as I pointed out earlier, that it's highly likely, and we'll be able to verify in a moment, that all of the investor-owned utilities rates are above the national average for that particular rate class. It's largely because, and this is a guess, it's not based upon any study, that if you move to certain other areas of the country, you'd have extremely large industrial customers that would drive, in a sense, the cost per unit down. Mm. Nevertheless, it's something we think about, because if a customer that fit into those classes came to our area, their other areas that they could go to might have lower rates. And so we want to be very conscious of that. So we do look at that.
And it's something that people, politicians in particular, tout, that we have low energy rates for economic development purposes, and this would suggest that's not necessarily true.
You know, the one thing that I want to, maybe what I should say is, I'm not sure about Ms. Miani's information, but the information we've been presenting has been, it's compiled by the Edison Electric Institute. It's essentially a survey of all of the rates of all of the utilities in the country by that organization to allow that we can do that kind of comparison. But they do group the customers into really three major categories: the industrial customers, the commercial customers, and the residential customers. And I do want to caution about over-interpreting that data. I think it's useful. But again, I think if we were to look at some other utilities with very large industrial-based customers, I'll use Minnesota Power as an example. Minnesota Power has, I believe it's 12 large customers up on the North Shore of Lake Superior that consume 70% of their kilowatt hours. I believe that's a correct, or something around that. So you can imagine that they have a cost to serve that is driven down on a per kilowatt hour basis. So it gets to some degree hard to compare those industrial services to every customer. Now, if a customer of the type that we typically serve, let's say it's an ag facility of some kind, were to be offered service in Minnesota Power's territory, it's difficult to say what would that rate comparison be. I mean, we have to do really point-to-point kinds of comparison. But it is informative. So I think it's informative, but one should be careful not to overinterpret the data. Mm-hmm. I think it's still a statement, a true statement, that we have in our area, and Otter Tail in particular, has some of the lowest rates in the nation, given the kinds of customers we serve. I think it bears out. Okay. If we had some large aluminum smelting, it might change that we might be able to drive that cost down per unit, too.
Okay. And the gap between the residential and the large industrial, has that has that grown over the course of the last 10 years without a rate case? Is that how it was baked in back then? Or speak to that a bit.
We may have the illustration that we had hoped for, which was the illustration of the comparison of our industrial rates to other utilities in North Dakota and the national average, similar to the ones that show up in my presentation. And I think that will help show not only where we are today, but where we have been over the recent past.
Thank you. Industrial rate comparison.
Mr. Gerhardsen, what do you have before you? And I'll note that we'll mark this as OTP Exhibit 52.
What this is a rate comparison of North Dakota industrial rates. It is based on data compiled by the Edison Electric Institute and is reflective of data from 2011 through 2017.
And is this the chart to which you were referring previously?
It is.
And obviously, was this prepared at your direction?
It was.
We'd offer Exhibit 52.
Okay, Mr. Pelham.
No objection.
Mr. Savico.
No objection.
Mr. Wieczorek.
No objection.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
No objection.
Okay, so Exhibit 52 is admitted. You may proceed, Commissioner Fedorchuk.
I think that effectively answers my last question, so I'm going to change direction a little bit. On this, do you call it the CIS one, or how do you guys refer to that?
We do refer to it as the CIS one project.
Okay. That is one of the biggest costs in this existing test year, is that correct?
It's not one of the biggest costs, but it is a driver of this rate increase request.
Okay. And it's come in just recently over budget.
We've changed the budget to reflect some additional time to integrate the project into our existing systems.
Okay. Do you anticipate additional budget increases on that project? I was hoping it would be like the AQCS project, come in under budget.
You know, I think that we do believe that it'll be placed in service in October. It is the most important thing for us, as I'm sure you know, that customer information system transitions can cause disruption with customers, confusion, or that sort of thing. So we are highly sensitive to nailing that so that our customers aren't inconvenienced by bills that are confusing in any way or not accurate. So while we're very conscious about the cost of that, I am very happy that the group that's working on it is being very diligent about that, because I do think that we would have worse circumstances. We are hoping that all projects come in like the AQCS project. That was such a tremendous project, and it was so large of an investment for us. We have had very good success with other similar projects at our power plants. In fact, at Hoot Lake, we added a required MATS, mercury, an air toxic standard project that also came in about 20% under the budgeted amount. We've had very good success on those transmission line projects that I mentioned, the Big Stone Area Transmission, for example. This project has some additional costs over what we had hoped for. It is, I think, entirely related to the additional time to do that integration successfully.
Okay. And that project, you had no other choice. You had to do that. It was time to just take that hit.
It was. We, number one, is we had to do it because the system that we had been using was, I don't know if I'm going to use the terminology right, but sort of like the DOS, a DOS-based kind of system. I mean, we're talking ancient technology. I don't think it was DOS-based. It was something else. But in my it just wasn't anything that could be continually updated and used with anything else that uses current technology. It also, we hope, has a becomes a platform for a lot of the benefits and the services that our customers are growing to expect. Outage management kinds of services, more sort of cell phone-based ability to review their materials or bill and other things on their phone. We didn't have a platform from which we could build any of those kinds of technological changes.
All right. This settlement basically approves the generation rider that you guys intend to use for the Astoria project, correct?
That is correct.
And then in that, I see that it says that the retirement-related changes to cost of service will be included as part of the calculation, so anything that you're saving from the retirement of Hoot Lake will be subtracted from the cost. Do you have any idea how much that might be?
It's difficult to study. So now we have several employees, obviously, that work there, and we need to make sure that they continue to work in that environment up until we're done with the facility. There is a transition expected at that time for those employees and for that staffing. And while there's, I think, numerous efforts to accommodate that through attrition and other things, it's difficult to predict all of what will have to occur to make that happen.
By transition, do you mean that they'll no longer be employed by the company? Likely?
Will you have employee savings? Correct. We hope that those who desire to remain employed will move to a different position within the company that is appropriate for them. It could be at another power plant facility, or it could be at another type of facility if their skills and desires so warrant. Again, there might be some opportunity, and you'd have to ask Mr. Wasberg, for attrition, somebody that was going to leave. But there is a certain minimum level of staffing we have up until the last day, obviously. Staffing is one of the things that will change, but it may not be the only cost change associated with decommissioning that plant. To be honest with you, we haven't done that with a larger facility for a long time, so it gets difficult to know exactly how those costs will play out. That's why I think that the settlement included a general commitment to evaluate that and incorporate it into that filing at that time.
So along with the rate increase for this case, customers will be needing to expect an increase for that project as well in the not-too-distant future.
That is correct.
For the Astoria project.
That is correct. There will be an increase associated with the Astoria project.
And then the transmission rider will be maintained to pay for a lot of the MISO charges, correct?
That's correct.
And the other renewable riders is that where AmeriCorps is going?
That's correct. We would expect that unless anything else changed, we would likely seek a rider recovery for the AmeriCorps project.
But all the other wind projects will be in rate base?
That's correct.
Okay. So it'll just be those two in the riders, and the AQCS is going into rate base, so the environmental rider goes away?
Correct.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the transmission costs, which have been increasing and continue to increase. What is the future look as it relates to transmission? Where is the end to that build out?
I may not be the best to answer this question, but I'll tell you what I think I know. I think that we have seen some build out and transmission costs increase, but we have seen a corresponding benefit because some of the big investments were meant to increase market efficiency, and that drives the cost of generation down, which is beneficial on the bill. And you're probably aware we've seen very, very low energy prices in the recent past. Not all of it's related to the transmission projects, but I think some of it is. When will that stop? I think it will depend upon the level of interconnections that occur. As you may know, there's a sort of a rush to interconnect currently because of the expected loss of the production tax credit. So there's a big sort of pig moving through the python, if you'll pardon the expression. What will occur after that gets difficult to predict, I think. Mm-hmm. Was that a sufficiently long answer?
Well, it concerns me that, and this is more of a MISO issue, but I'm just going to lay it out there now since we are talking about transmission costs in this case, that the transmission system is built to support an open market mm-hmm. where just about anybody can connect. Mm-hmm. And it isn't based on demand. So customers have to pay for that. And who says we don't need it?
Well, there are benefit analyses done through the MTEP process at MISO for those projects that you don't review. I mean, there are projects that you review where we are going to, you know, that are more of the sort of local projects where the bulk of the investment is going to be paid for by our retail customers. For those large projects, we're in a beneficial state, and our customers are in that, not a state meaning North Dakota necessarily, but in our region, in that we're allocated only our consumption from those in terms of our costs. So Otter Tail is about just under 1% of the total consumption in MISO, and therefore we're allocated only that amount for those MVP projects that are allocated system-wide. So we've benefited from some large infrastructure being built in our region and only having to pay, well, frankly, less than 1%. Mm-hmm. So right now, while the costs have gone up, we've gotten a lot of beneficial transmission built with a relatively low price.
And you mentioned a minute ago that the energy prices are low and having access to those. A part of that whole issue of having low energy prices is having the transmission that allows it to go. So do you think that that's fair to say to customers, yes, there's a lot of transmission being built, and yes, you're paying for it, but it's keeping your bills down?
Because these are
the lower prices are lower than the increase in the cost for the transmission, and it's a net benefit.
Yeah, well, I mean, opposed as you've said it, absolutely. If it's going to reduce the price on the bill, it's beneficial. It's fairly easy.
But does it? I guess that's.
I think, those are questions that people at a higher policy level than I, not only in the company but in the country, are discussing what is most beneficial and optimal.
Are you sure that discussion?
Well, they're supposed
happening?
To be discussing.
Because I'm not.
Let's say they're supposed. They should be discussing it. And you're asking about things that maybe I'm not the best to answer. I haven't done much to, you know, study the workings of the entire MISO market. I would say that we have seen a corresponding, you know, low price in the recent past. And I, in my little more than lay understanding, I have to say that it seems to correlate to some degree with increased transmission infrastructure to reduce congestion.
Okay. That's good. I will make a pitch that Stacy's very valuable voice in MISO, and so I hope that Otter Tail will continue to support her and others being involved there, because we need our companies to have a voice in that arena.
We appreciate the affirmation. Thank you.
I note that on... page 10 of your slideshow. The residential, I want to talk a little bit about the basic service charges where I'm going right now. The residential increase average under the settlement is $7.54. And then when you look at the chart on the page 8 of the settlement, where it shows the increase in the proposed customer charges, that goes up from 8 for residential to 1523. and that difference is 723. So I don't know if it's a fair way of looking at it, but this is how I'm looking at it. 723 is basic service charge, and the total increase is 754. So it's almost 100% being allocated through the customer service charge,
I think the residential increase. Commissioner Fedorchuk, I think that's a fair interpretation. Some of what's difficult here is that the 754 on slide 10 is based upon an average consumer. On the fixed charge would, of course, apply to each consumer regardless of consumption patterns.
Right.
But ultimately, for that average consumer, that is correct, that the bulk of the increase would show up in the fixed customer charge. The alternative would be to increase energy charges.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me about why that makes sense for you or your company now in this particular case.
Well, long and short is our fixed charge is far lower than I believe any utility in the state, and it doesn't represent the fixed costs of service, so those costs that don't change depending upon your consumption patterns. So if we looked at other utilities like Xcel Energy, I believe theirs is around $14. That's my memory, so it's subject to check on that. And their cost to provide the fixed portion of service is actually lower than ours. So theirs is, I think, just a little over $14. And you, I think in maybe the last rate case that was in front of the commission, set their fixed charge at $14. Our neighboring cooperatives often have fixed charges more in the $30 range, $25, maybe up to $40, based upon their fixed costs of service. So there is, to some degree, some lag in our fixed charge. I have to believe we are the very lowest by a strong margin. And what that does is it doesn't appropriately send signals. It tends to burden those who have a larger amount of consumption of energy. So if you have a larger home, drafty, say, you're getting hit with a larger bill because you're consuming more kilowatt hours.
So point me to the study or the analysis that gets to what the appropriate fixed charge, fixed costs are. What analysis is that? Cost of service study? I mean, which one of these things?
I believe it's in the I'm not sure who has it. I would maybe have to have one of the other witnesses remind me where that shows up in our testimony, but it does.
Yeah.
And it is I think it's called I can't remember what the study is called. This is just a little beyond my
Somebody can get back on that, and yes. It wasn't something that anybody disputed, so there's not a lot of other discussion, but it is something that we hear a lot about, so I'd like to have some of the justification brought to light a little bit more.
I'll point you to the place in the record where that shows up.
Okay, very good. Okay, I think that concludes my questions. Thank you.
Hey, Council. Mr. Stephenson, any redirect?
Very briefly, Your Honor. Mr. Gerhardsen, I'll show you what is OPP Exhibit 12. And earlier, do you recall a question regarding a chart of our capital spending?
I do recall a question about our capital spending in different periods.
Okay. I'll show you what is Figure 5 in your direct testimony, Exhibit 12.
Yes. That's the chart I was referring to that helped to identify what investments Otter Tail has made in the recent past and has planned for the near-term future. In response to questions, I think, by both Mr. Crotius, Commissioner Crotius, and Commissioner Chrisman.
Which page are we looking at on Exhibit 12?
Page 19. It's Figure 5 in OTP Exhibit 12.
And does that chart break out by project or category the nature of our capital expenditures in the past and going forward?
It does.
Thank you.
Mr. Gerhardsen, earlier Commissioner Chrisman had asked you some questions concerning a number in your step-through analysis in the reductions, and have you had an opportunity to review that?
In my step-through in the reductions? Yeah, maybe. Is that on the slide 10?
Oh. And I forgive me if I don't characterize the question properly, but it concerned a number that Commissioner Chrisman was interested in, a differential step down from, what was it, 7 point?
Yes. The Commissioner Chrisman, as I recall, asked me about how much of the reductions that you would see between the 13.1 and the $7.5 million reflected, I think on page 3 of my presentation, how much was related to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We did put a $4.5 million reduction in our interim rates in February, I believe. We later determined that the appropriate amount was $4.8 million, so that's what's reflected in the settlement, is a reduction of $4.8 million. And in the, I believe that it does turn into a $4.8 million amount during the interim rate period, for which there will be an amount, that amount will be reflected in the interim rate refund calculation. So the customers will get 100% of the benefit of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act during all periods that it was in effect. There was a question about which study, I think it was from Commissioner Fedorchuk, that certain information was found. Does that ring any bells?
Well, it's information that my staff put together about how close we are moving residential class to cost. So we are moving them 86% of the way there, not 100% of the way there, to their full cost of service.
I think there was a question. There was a question of which study that we used to determine our fixed costs. And I don't think you were.
You're thinking I remembered it now?
well, maybe the material that.
We do a marginal cost service study. And it's my belief that that's where that is done. But I have to say that's what I could not remember, but subject to check, I believe it's the marginal cost study. And I don't recall which witness sponsored that.
No further redirect, Your Honor.
It counts across. Mr. Pelham.
No questions.
Mr. Savico.
I think just one, Your Honor, or maybe a series. Mr. Gerhardsen, I don't know if you recall, you were asked a question about the PTCs and passing that back by, I believe, Commissioner Christman. Do you recall that line of question?
I do.
MLIC participated when that rider was decided and how PTC was passed back. Do you recall that?
I do.
So I'm going to ask.
I maybe should clarify. I don't recall if it was MLEC at the time or whether it was a North Dakota group of customers that were assembled for that purpose, but essentially the same customers that I think you represent today.
Thank you. Now, with respect to how a wind farm recovery happens in a rider, would you agree that when it's placed in service, there's a large revenue requirement relative to at the end, meaning there's a large capitalized amount? For example, if a wind farm costs $100 million, revenue requirement would be based on that capital cost, correct?
Yes.
So then as you get to year 20 through 25, it's relatively close to fully depreciated, and the revenue requirement would be significantly smaller. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
So necessarily, the power that is being paid for by those later customers is at a far lower cost than those on the front end.
For that individual generating facility, yes.
Okay. Thank you. I've got no further questions.
Mr. Wieczorek, do you have any questions?
No questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Yes, I have several. I'll apologize. There is not another witness that's going to talk specifically about any of the other, like, more expense provisions of the settlement or anything. You're the witness to ask those questions of, correct?
Unless I'm unable to answer the questions adequately, confidently.
Well, first on the riders, I did have several questions, but many of them have been asked and answered. But in your conversation with Commissioner Fedorchuk, you were talking about the environmental rider, and one of you said the rider's going away. The rider is not actually going away. It's just that it's going to be zero unless and until there's another. Is that correct, or is it going literally coming out of the tariff book?
It's my understanding it would go to zero, which would effectively make it a no rate at all on our bills. You're correct. It probably would remain in the rate book in case and in the event it was beneficial in the future to request that the commission allow something to be used, to be used for something else.
Okay. That was my understanding from the case, but I wanted to be sure I knew what we were looking at here. So I was going to ask a little bit more about what riders you had and which projects were going into which ones, but those have been asked and answered. But I still wanted to know your good reasons for having this generation rider. We've got statutes providing policy direction for two types of riders. We've got the kinds of things that Mr. Savickel just talked about for the good reasons for renewable wind riders, for lack of a better term. But I'm still kind of, you know, the jury's out in my head on this generation rider. So tell me why Otter Tail thinks that it needs a rider for those costs.
There's several benefits to rider recovery that can be mentioned. I think, you know, first and foremost, a rider recovery can alleviate the need for a rate case. Why is that beneficial? It's beneficial because Otter Tail has a relatively small number of customers in North Dakota, and the costs of a rate case are very high, not only on the company but on the administrative process. So it's been our general belief that a reasonable amount of rate cases is beneficial. Too frequent a rate case can result in cost, because the costs of rate cases get recovered from customers, and they can often be a big number. I haven't done the math but I am guessing it's in the cost of a rate case might be $25 per customer, for example, which is a significant amount when the kinds of increases we're talking about are in the single digits. So generally speaking, I think it's beneficial and efficient. That's not the only benefit. There's another benefit in that for multi-year construction projects, we can commence recovery during the period of construction, and it starts out small and it ramps up, and by doing so, we avoid the accrual of AFUDC. AFUDC is like a construction loan in terms of rate making. It's like a construction loan that you would add to your mortgage at the end of the construction period. So in other words, you now depreciate that over the life of the project. So there's sort of a benefit of a pay-as-you-go approach that can reduce the overall rates over time. A third benefit is it's, I think, very favorable in the capital when we're seeking both debt and equity capital to see that kind of support for the kind of investment we're talking about, the very, very large investment. So that can reduce the cost of borrowing, which then translates into lower rates for customers. As you know, we're generally authorized to recover the cost of debt and equity for our capital investments. So there is a benefit in that.
So aside from the rate case, minimizing the number of rate cases perhaps, there are some, in your mind at least, tangible cost reductions to ratepayers from having a rider like that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to ask a little bit about the settlement provisions that talk about the expense items and the adjustments to them. And that kind of a last provision toward the end, I think I have it written down. Toward the end, I think it might be page 11. Well, I shouldn't say the end. That might be the middle. But let me find it.
This is page 11 in
page 11 of the settlement.
Settlement agreement.
The other terms and conditions where it says issues not specifically addressed except as provided in the settlement, the Otter Tail's positions on issues from the rebuttal testimony shall be deemed adopted. Okay, so some of those words scare me a little bit. Because I understand the concept of reaching, a compromise, and I understand even not saying, well, we're allowing this and we're disallowing that, mm-hmm. because you're compromising and you're reaching a number. But I don't recall in many settlements seeing that kind of a statement, and especially the use of the word position and the use of the word adopted. So in my mind, I'd like more information from you about what positions you mm-hmm. think are still remaining out there that haven't been addressed in the settlement, mm-hmm. Because there is a list
sure.
of the expense items, but I don't know how that list relates to the position of Otter Tail on those items. And then I'd like to know if the parties to the settlement, especially Otter Tail, truly are asking the commission to adopt your position then as an order.
Well, first of all, thanks for the question. I think it's helpful to clarify that. It's not our – I think the only thing we're trying to say with that is when we began settlement discussions, we had to begin with a fixed point, you know, whose numbers and at what point are we beginning the discussion. So I think at least by the time of the rebuttal testimony, those were the numbers we were working from. And so when parties were saying, hey, I would ask that you change this number or that number, those were the base case that we were starting from. So I understand sort of your concern that does it go to sort of a precedential quality if our positions are adopted. That is not what we intended by that language. Our intent was only that we arrive at the figures used for the settlement starting with the base case of our rebuttal testimony. We do have other language in the settlement agreement which is intended to say that there is no precedential effect, because I can understand how you and the commission would want to know that in another rate case in another time for another utility, you may say that some expense or some cost is not allowable, and this would not be, you would not be wanting to intend this as precedent setting. So we are not intending that language to mean anything like that. We're just meaning to say it's the starting point. The adjustments that are referenced are to that.
And that part I understand. I would, do you happen to know where that not, it's not precedent language is? What page are you on, Counselor? Page 12. If that particular provision were tweaked slightly, because I still see this as more specific, and that is the more generic settlement, standard settlement canned language thing, perhaps would that be a deal breaker for Otter Tail?
It would not be a deal breaker for either us as parties or the commission in its order to clarify that it's adopting the data from the rebuttal testimony and not necessarily any of the positions of any party.
Okay. And thank you. And then are there specific provisions of the settlement where a determination was made as to how something was going to be handled that is a deviation from your last rate case, that would be precedent? You know, it was treated this way in the last rate case. The settlement now is treating it differently. Are there any of those that should be pointed out for the commission? Or do you need time to think about that when we come?
I can't think of anything that isn't something that was that wasn't an occurrence back in that time. We have, I think, to some degree, at the time of our last rate case, Otter Tail Corporation, as opposed to Otter Tail Power Company, was adjusting to certain services that it would provide. Sort of, and we have a very small corporate staff that does certain things for the company, such as auditing. Of course, we have our corporate executives, the ones that the SEC, mostly cares about at that level. And I believe the allocations since that last rate case are being handled differently. They're explained in great detail in a cost allocation manual that is part of this record and probably was part of the record in the last rate case, although I can't recall it. But there may have been some subtle changes in how and what costs were being allocated. I don't believe they would be material. I believe that one thing that was pointed out and in the settlement was that the stock-based compensation, which was disallowed, would not have been included in the last rate case. But it's not included in the settlement either. So that's the one thing I can think of that was a difference that is no longer a difference.
I'm not recalling, I did review that order and settlement, but quickly, I'm not recalling that the corporate allocation was specifically part of that old order and settlement. It might have been part of the case, but I don't know that it was part of the old order and settlement. But
my memory is actually that our corporate entity was not formed until 2009.
Okay.
And there was sort of a group that we thought of as corporate administrative folks, but there was no corporate legal entity at the last rate case, is my memory.
There was one provision in that old order, though, that piqued my curiosity, the margin sharing.
Margin
sharing. Is any margin sharing still going on? Are you selling anything?
We don't do – that's what are called at the time when the market, the energy market this is, and to some degree the ancillary services market, there was activity in our marketing group that was unrelated to the provision of electric service to our retail customers, meaning we might buy energy somewhere with the sole intent of selling it to some other utility. And there was at that time in that settlement agreement, some sort of a sharing is my memory.
Yes.
Or I may take this back. It might also have dealt with the energy markets were getting off the ground, and there might have been some sort of an incentive that to the degree we were selling even our own generation into the market, there was some amount that we were entitled to retain. Number one is we don't do that, what I'll call non-retail-based marketing to any degree anymore. That staff is gone, so it wouldn't be irrelevant to the settlement. And my memory of this settlement does not include any incentive for marketing our generation, and I have to say the markets have changed to a degree that it's sort of we've just moved on. So,
okay. One last question. The recovery of the environmental reagents and emissions allowance expenses, it says moving it out of base rates and out of the reagent and emissions allowance rider into the energy adjustment rider. Can you explain that to me? Is it in base rates or is it in a rider? And if it's in a rider, why move it?
Okay, so it was in a rider. We had requested that it be moved into the fuel clause. The reagents that we use at a power plant are the amount we use is going to rise and fall with the dispatch of that power plant. So to a degree, it is variable to a large degree exactly as fuel is. So there are times we use a lot or times we use a little, and it has – so the costs vary on that basis. So we had at one time requested that they go there, but because we had the environmental rider and some of those costs, if memory serves, were related to the air quality control system at the Big Stone facility, there was a desire to segment them and treat them under this, I don't know if it was a separate rider. I think this came out of sort of a negotiation with the commission. It was either a separate rider or something that was embedded within the environmental equipment rider. Because we're moving that environmental equipment rider into base rates, we said, well, let's talk about this again. So in this proceeding, we requested that it go to the fuel clause. That way we could get rid of the environmental rider as a separate thing and this whatever rider you just described, believing there's a simplicity benefit there, and because it so tracks with dispatch that we thought that the fuel clause, and in fact this is what they do in South Dakota is my memory, so we have some experience with it being treated on that basis. Now I will say there is an amount that was in base rates. It was like pebble lime, I believe, at the Coyote facility. That's been used at that facility for some time. That was in base rates, not in the rider. That would, under this settlement, be moved into the fuel clause for the same reason, that it's variable along with the dispatch of the unit.
So it seems to me that the whole reagent rider could literally come out of the tariff book.
I believe it could once it's transitioned, unless anyone on my team thinks there's any reason. I would be happy to. We would do a separate proceeding unless you thought we needed to do it here where we would just cancel it.
I think if the proposal is to, I mean, the environmental rider, you might have environmental costs that you need to use it for, but the reagent is already in use.
I think that's reasonable. We could do it here.
I think it could be done if you're willing to do it in your compliance filing.
Look for heads shaking.
Yeah, okay.
No heads are shaking. So mm-hmm. I think that sounds like a reasonable opportunity to simplify the rate book.
That's all I have, I think, unless Jerry has something. I think that's all we have. Thank you very much.
Hey, commissioners, Commissioner Kocious.
Just one follow-up. It might be several questions, but on the original application, on the tariff sheets, they reflected a drop in energy charges.
That could be the case, Commissioner Kocious, for at least some of the rates. I would have to look at them each to determine whether that's the case.
I'll just, for large general service, that reflects a significant decrease, at least in and there are different areas on that. But the question is, did those energy charge differences, did they change? In the original application, did the TCJA then change them, I'm assuming, and then where did they land?
We would have an updated set of rate schedules in the supplemental testimony or in the rebuttal testimony, I believe, in supplemental testimony. And so they would change at that time.
And here's what I'm really getting at, and that would be on your PowerPoint Exhibit 49 on page 10. It shows large general service, the pre-filing monthly bill at $12,425, and then the settlement, typical monthly bill number would be $12,306, so that has gone down, but then there's an asterisk on actually every customer classification may vary based on customer usage and other factors. Just like to get a better handle on how that ties out to, obviously there are calculations behind the $12,306.45, and maybe it's in testimony buried somewhere that I didn't uncover, but I'm just looking at this for the first time. So,
I think I understand the nature of the question, if I could hazard a response. Commissioner Crosius, I think it's a great question about how does rate design work, and when we talk about rate design, what do we mean? For the customer classes that you're talking about there, they have several components of their bill for their consumption, usually some fixed charges, some demand charges, and some energy charges. And in each rate case, one of the things we do in rate design is we try to determine what should the – what we've got to collect a certain amount from that group of customers, and we've got to determine – how much is each customer, in a sense, causing costs for us? So what we use is that marginal cost study. And one of the things that can change quite a bit between rate cases is the relative amount, rather relative cost of demand versus energy. And that can change in any number of ways. The cost of demand could go up, the cost of energy could go down, or any either one of those components. So each rate case, what we try to do, because we can't price these things any more frequently than a rate case, is we reset those in a rate case. So the component parts of their bill are giving them the best price signals we can to so that they can interpret that behavior. And if they, for example, if energy costs were going way up in the marketplace, we would change their rates so that if they used a lot of energy, it would cost them more so that they are appropriately sort of thinking about that. What's occurred since our last rate case is that energy prices have gone down, as I'm sure you're well aware, so the component portion of their bill related to energy use correspondingly goes down relative to the other components of the bill. I hope that explains it, but it's not uncommon when we, especially when we have 10 years between a rate set.
Yeah. No, it. I mean, that helps, but really what I'm getting at is, and I understand those points, you know, how typical is typical? And just, I'm assuming for the average customer using, large general, using 173,000 and change kilowatt hours per month, their bill will be reduced. Their overall utility bill will go down.
Commissioner Crosius, that is correct, as I understand what you're stating, yes. And I will say that you're correct that in, especially in that customer class, you can have very big differences between a small member of that class and a very large member of that class. We don't tend to see that big of a spread in a residential customer. While there can be, you know, somebody with a very large consumption and small consumption in residential, I mean, on the industrial scale, it's quite, you can have quite a big difference. But we have to start with something to identify what is the typical impact. So we do start with what is kind of an average usage for the whole group.
So the higher the usage within that class, the large general service class, is it safe to say the greater the reduction will be in terms of what they experience?
If the reduction, pardon me, if the usage is energy only, I would have to consider what their demands are, and the demands, as you know, relate to some degree to their consumption at specific times. But if they were, for example, a low-demand, high-energy user, we typically refer to those as having a high load factor, they would benefit whenever energy prices go down.
Okay, and just to make sure I heard this correctly, under this settlement, it would get you, is it 84% of the way there in terms of rebalancing?
That's for the residential class.
Residential.
And I have, we didn't do the math, I don't think, for the large general service.
But is 80, did I write that down correctly? Was it 84?
84, 86. So just, 84 sounds right.
Okay, but for the, just about all of the way, I mean, very close to. 86. Mm-hmm. 86? Okay. Okay, no other questions for me at this time. Thank you.
Chairman Christman.
One of advocacy staff's witnesses in their testimony recommended denial of $200,000 of economic development money. What's the status of that with this settlement?
It has not been disallowed, so we would, if the settlement is approved on this basis, we would go forward with in returning, really, our economic development activities to the towns that we serve in North Dakota.
What do you mean by returning them, returning back to it? Because this would be a departure from the 2008 rate case.
Correct. It's a departure from that rate case, but prior to that, we had authority and did have an economic development program in the state. This is similar to that.
I have no other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak, you've been waiting to ask a question, I know.
So, also one of the advocacy staff witnesses, I've done a little bit more digging and found their objection to your proposal on the customer charge level, and they were advocating for a softer switch, not going 90% of the way there, to their cost, to their real marginal cost, or whatever you, whatever the term is, fixed costs. Are you guys open to making that change in the settlement, or how firmly are you on that particular piece, just substituting, doing it more gradual where we wouldn't do that large of an increase on the customer charge, putting more of it on the volumetric charge?
Commissioner Fedorchak, it's our preference to resolve this as we've proposed in the settlement. We're certainly open to ideas. A couple things that maybe to point out is that when we read the testimony of staff consultants, some of the perspectives that were being advanced were not, as we understood it, consistent with North Dakota policy on this subject. We understand that in certain parts of the country there is advocacy to artificially suppress fixed charges in order to increase the value of distributed energy resources such as rooftop solar. It appeared to us that that was the position being taken by staff's consultant. In fact, I think they explicitly said so. So while they're advocating for that, unless we understood that there had been a change in policy, we don't think it would be consistent with other things that have occurred in the state of North Dakota. One example might be Xcel's, which I understand in their last rate proceeding, I think they increased their fixed charge to $14 flat, and their cost of service study said that the fixed charge or the fixed costs were $14.08. So they are much closer, I think. So if we go back to that 85%, they are much closer to their costs, at least as demonstrated in that last rate case, than we would be under the current settlement. And although I probably should take back, that may have more to do with the class cost of service allocations, meaning we're not allocating as much costs overall to the residential class, but we are asking for the fixed charge to be at cost. Back to your question, how we think it's important that we take a good step toward the fixed charge. We do understand that sometimes there is a policy preference for moderation. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair enough answer?
Sure. I would say I noted some of the rationale for the opposition to the fixed charge isn't consistent with how we viewed things most recently. However, we do have some precedent for taking a more gradual approach and doing this in stages, not taking such a giant leap all at once.
Can I add one other piece of information on that? And one of the things that may make Otter Tail a little bit differently, and this is, of course, difficult information to study, but one thing we noticed is that a lot of utilities that serve more urban areas, that their lowest consumption users tend to be in the lower income brackets. In our service territory, we have a higher portion of people in our lower income brackets in larger use categories. So one of the reasons that this issue has been for other utilities often suppressed so that not the entire amount is made up is that there's a perception that it's equitable to those smaller users of kilowatt hours. For us, it actually cuts the other way, I believe. And so that's one of the reasons we're comfortable advancing this as a proposal.
What sort of documentation do you have to show that, to back up what you just stated?
It's in the testimony of Dave Prozek, I believe in his rebuttal testimony, I believe, but it might be in his direct testimony as well.
Okay. And is it a statement? Is it just a,
It's some analysis of low-income qualified consumers, I believe.
Okay.
But
the LIHEAP stuff?
I believe, but
okay.
I'm stretching my memory.
I'll peek at that. So it's your preference to take a strong step that way, but you aren't tied to the percentage right here, 100%.
We certainly would take the policy input of the commission
okay.
seriously. I mean, obviously, so I wouldn't oppose it. At the same time, we'll urge it.
Yeah.
And I also like, for the record, I know you know this, but just for the record and for the average consumer, that reducing the fixed charge can sometimes be misinterpreted to reduce rates. It doesn't. It just moves the rates from the fixed charge to the energy charge. So if we were to change the fixed rates, we would have to subsequently, or not subsequently, as part of that, we would be increasing the energy charges. So it doesn't reduce the burden on some customers without increasing the burden on others.
It does, though, potentially reduce the burden for low-use customers. I mean, it definitely
if
does.
If we move to the proposal we yeah. have, we do, and we no. have to say some because we can't say for all, but the if you look at the testimony, we can't say that for all. Or low-use, yes, you're
low
correct.
Low-use, yeah.
Yes, it would increase, in a sense, the percentage burden of a low-use customer, but it... it's still a moderate dollar amount.
Sure. Very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Stephenson, anything you want to redirect on? I'll allow you that opportunity, given the late questions, you know, from commissioners and stuff.
No, Your Honor, we have no more redirect for Mr. Gerhardt.
Okay, then, Mr. Pelham?
No questions.
Mr. Savico.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do have one question. Mr. Gerhardsen, you were referring to an 86% closer to cost. Is that? Can you tell me in what context that was and what that 86% is of?
I think I may have even misspoke when I started answering about that. I was talking about the fixed charge, and that's not correct to say that we were trying to get it to 86% of the fixed charge. We were the 86%, I think, is relative to the allocation of costs overall to the customer class, residential customers, it means that there's still a bit of a subsidy from other rate classes to the residential class.
Okay. And that's based on?
The class cost of service.
The class cost of service study. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
So thank you for helping me clarify that on the record.
Mr. Wieczorek.
No questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Yes. The economic development question is a good example of what I was asking you about. You had said that you didn't think this settlement deviated from the previous order, but that's an example where it does.
That is correct.
Deviate from the previous order.
That is correct.
It's also,
I didn't recall that. My apologies.
Okay. It's also a good example of my little bit of a problem with the wording in the settlement that I'm hoping, rather than the commission trying to fix it in a decision, that the parties can maybe work on it. But the part of the settlement that talks about it not being precedent says it doesn't set policy or overturn precedent. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't say what I was worrying about, which is setting precedent. Okay, and this economic development would be a good example. In your interpretation, you could do it. You could, with the commission's permission, spend ratepayer money on economic development. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then that would be precedent going forward. And this settlement language that I just looked at on page 12 says it doesn't overturn precedent, doesn't say it doesn't set precedent. So I'm just a little concerned about it. We'll mm-hmm. have to sort our way through it, mm-hmm. but I'm bringing it up so you begin to think about it as well.
Well,
and if the if the commission were to draw some parameters around those topics, would that be a deal breaker for Otter Tail?
It would not be a deal breaker, and I think we're trying to arrive at the same place.
Okay, thank you.
I think that just looking at the settlement agreement here today, it's being offered to the commission to make its determination, but it's not binding on the commission, and there are other inconsistencies possibly in the boilerplate. If you look at paragraph 3, it says this settlement agreement shall not constitute part of the record. Well, it already is part of the record, and it'll soon be on the internet. So regardless of whether it's adopted by the commission or not, it's already part of the record. And obviously I think the commission has the ultimate decision to make here on all of these issues, and that will be what carries the day, I think. So any other questions, commissioners, for Mr. Gerhardsen before we allow him to take a break? Okay, I think you can step down, Mr. Gerhardsen. I want to ask Mr. Stephenson, given the nature of the questions this morning and the responses, do you feel the need to call additional witnesses?
I doubt so. Your Honor, I doubt so, but if we could just have a couple of minutes.
Well, that's what I – why don't we break for lunch now? And is 1 o'clock soon enough, or can we all be back by 1 o'clock?
Could you say 1:15?
1:15. Okay. So we'll reconvene at 1:15, and instead of you resting now, we'll give you the opportunity to talk with your people and see if there's anything that maybe they think they can clarify when we come back. And commissioners, is there anything else that you would want to have them get into when they come back? Questions you felt maybe haven't been answered adequately yet?
I'm pretty satisfied with
okay. All right. So we'll come back at 1:15, and then we'll go from there.
I assume they're just...